CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talks Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool and Business. And this week I'm joined by a live audience of leading members of the city's business community for a very special event from the Crown Plaza Hotel. My guest today is the man who was arguably the most single important catalyst for the transformation of the Liverpool that we see today. Following the Toxteth riots in the early 80s, he was appointed to a position that became known as the Minister for Merseyside, and he set about turning around the fortunes of our city through a series of innovative projects and driving through an agenda of change by developing strong partnerships between the public and private sectors. Securing financial backing for some vitally important physical regeneration schemes, most notably the Garden Festival site and the Albert Dock, his positive input started a process that has seen Liverpool become a successful modern 21st century city. Please give a warm downtown welcome to Lord Michael Heseltine. Lord Heseltine, welcome to Liverpool.
Thank you.
Delighted to see you here. I don't want to spend too much time talking about the past because I know there's a lot of important initiatives that you're involved with as far as the future is concerned. But I'm sure people would be interested to reflect on where Liverpool was back in the 80s and how that unique appointment actually came about.
In 1978, we had the Winter of Discontent under Mr. Callaghan's government. And the strike situation here was so bad that you couldn't bury the dead. They were stacking the bodies up because the funeral staff were on strike. But everyone was on strike. I mean, it was closed down time. And it was actually, looking back over it historically, it was the moment when the power of the trade unions was broken. It took the Conservative government to actually legislate to bring that about. But that was the point at which what had been Harold Wilson's and Barbara Castle's first attempt to come to terms with the union power, Ted Heath's attempt to do a voluntary control, Callaghan continued that process, and the unions bust his government in 78. That was the background against which the Conservatives came to power. It was a powerless state. And interestingly enough, my relationship with Liverpool began then in 79. The innovations that you mentioned actually came in 79, the big ones, not 81. But the innovations of the saving the Albert Dock, of the Urban Development Corporation, of the Garden Festival, they gave me an involvement in Liverpool, which I'd inherited from my predecessor in the Labour government, Peter Shaw. That meant I came, not very often, no minister ever does go anywhere very often, but I had some feeling. And then in 1981, there were the riots, and I felt a personal responsibility that this had happened without me understanding what was going wrong. And so, in answer to your question, how did it come about, I went to Mrs. Thatcher, and I said, look, you can, if you like, or others can, depict this as law and order and put the police in and sort it. But I don't accept that analysis. It's much more worrying. There's something deeper going on in Britain's urban areas. And I want to just leave my department for 3 weeks to walk the streets of Liverpool and listen. And she said, yes, okay. And so I came, and people said, what have you come for? I said, something's gone wrong. I've come to listen. Everybody says ministers never listen. I'm listening. I'm listening like mad. Well, it lasted about 4 or 5 days, and every time I was asked, I said, I'm listening. And people said, well, it's all very well listening. What are you going to do? And it became apparent to me very rapidly that I couldn't get away from Liverpool without having some sort of agenda. And so we learned the lesson that had already borne in on us, which I'll say a word about, and we produced this agenda of some 30 projects. One of which was the Tate Gallery, for example. We said, this is what we're going to try and do. And what were we trying to do? In a simple sentence, we were trying to persuade people that things could work in Liverpool. The despair, the hopelessness, the lack of leadership, the lack of anybody who would take a decision was borne in on us in that first few days of walking around and listening to people. No one was doing anything. No one was leading. And so I felt, well, OK, I'll show them. It can be done. And I had this project list of 30 projects. I came every Thursday. I went to, I had a team, of which Max was one, and over dinner in the Atlantic Tower. We went through each project. They told me about progress. They told me about the blockages. And I spent the Friday moving the blockages. And then I went south again. And I was back the following Thursday to repeat the process until I became Defence Secretary in 83.
And during that period of time, you've mentioned the, some of the blockages, some of the barriers. I think one of the frustrating things that people sometimes have with the public sector, private sector, public sector split, is the fact that there is seems to be a bit too much bureaucracy, perhaps not enough understanding from public sector agencies about what businesses need. But you seem to be very successful in putting together public-private sector partnerships that actually did deliver very important projects.
That started in 1979 in Liverpool, and I inherited, again from Peter Shaw, what I have, I'm afraid, described as a slush fund, that he had £189 million a year of capital expenditure that he could allocate to local authorities with stress areas. And so once the major capital had been allocated, Peter could come along and add more. So people got their housing, they got their transport, they got their environment, and then he'd come along and he'd put a bit more in. And I said to myself, well, this is all very well, but they've been pouring money, public money, into these areas, and actually they're merely consolidating the problems that are there. What you've got to do is bring about a fundamental change in the economic and social makeup of the deprived areas. And so my first visit to Liverpool in 79, I said to the assembled audience, look, I've got the fund, and it's still available. There's one condition, and that is you've got to spend it in conjunction with the private sector. And that was, I mean, today, that sounds, well, what, so what? Mm. That was revolution in 1979. The two sides didn't talk. They shouted at each other from mountaintops, words of abuse. And so when I said, fine, we're going on, business as usual, except the private sector will be involved. The second question was devastating, of course, as it so often is. What do you mean by the private sector? There was no leadership in the private sector. There were no effective private sector organizations. There was a chamber of commerce that was pretty hopeless, like most chambers of commerce at that time. But I had no choice. There's no use sitting there as Secretary of State and saying, I don't know. So I had to say something. So I said, well, Chamber of Commerce. And as I said it, I thought, oh, my God, I've got problems here. You know. Anyway, we got over that. And very rapidly, the best example and the one that began to develop quite rapidly were the house builders. Because the simplest answer to my derelict land, clear it with public money, was, and get me a house builder who'd put houses on it. And that, in London, took off very fast. In Liverpool, it took off, but it was the beginning of the public-private sector partnerships. And of course, human beings, being what they are, when Bill and Ben, who hated each other's guts and had sworn infinite death to each other, suddenly found themselves in the room, they found that they were just the same sort of people, you know. So they worked together. And if you ask me of one of the hidden and most persuasive, pervasive changes in this country in my political lifetime, it is now that the public and private sector are interrelated. Yeah. They don't shout at each other. They listen, they talk. Now, there are frustrations, of course, as you ask, but the fusion of the two is a great advance. And if I'm frank, it is one of the tragedies of this country is that for the post-war period, most of it, the two sides saw each other as enemies, whereas in most classical capitalist economies, they worked much more effectively together.
I know that you are a great believer in public sector intervention where it can make a difference, and those partnership arrangements that you initiated here clearly demonstrated that. How difficult do you think it might be for the public sector to participate going forward, given where we're at in terms of public expenditure and the general economy at the moment?
Well, you see, I'm a heretic in this matter. I believe passionately, and I would almost go as far as say I know, there is no capitalist economy with which we compete that doesn't actually have a very powerful public sector input into its strength. And I know the classic situation of small businesses who say, get off our back, get red tape out of the way, sack a few civil servants and the whole world will smile. It's absolute rubbish, complete rubbish. I mean, let me give you several examples because it then brings it home. The American high-tech industries, you know, giant companies across the world. Have you any idea how much the Pentagon, the defense budget, the NASA spend on high-tech research and development in the United States? Astronomic sums of money that is loss leading, doesn't have to show a return. It is pioneering the advances of modern science in the hands of the private sector with which we've then got to compete. Fact one. Fact two, in Germany, they have a thing called the DIN system, and the German government and its engineering system industry get together, and the government raises the standards of manufacturing product year after year after year. And that means quite a lot of small companies can't keep up. They fall away. But the big ones, the good ones, and they're not all big, they become better and better. And if you want to know why the German economy is growing by 3% at the moment, it is on the back of an export boom because the German manufacturing base is the best in Europe. The defense industries and the pharmaceutical industries are amongst our most effective exporting markets. They are also two of the most tightly regulated manufacturing industries in our country. NHS regulates the standards of the health service. Ministry of Defense regulates the procurement of military equipment. University expenditure on research and development, massively important to the private sector. And I can go on and on and on with examples of this sort. So understanding the relationship of the public and private sector is very important in the workings of an advanced capitalist economy today. You haven't heard me use the word subsidy, you haven't heard the word nationalization, you haven't heard any of the sort of words that are associated with left-wing attitudes. What you're hearing is a capitalist approach to using the resources of the state to build wealth in the capitalist system. That's what I mean by intervention. It's knowing that there is this relationship and trying to make it work.
And you mentioned earlier leadership and the lack of leadership that existed in Liverpool when you arrived.
Let me start on that. Everyone in this room will think, my God, yes. 1945, nationalisation of the Bank of England. It used to be independence in the provinces. 1945 to 1950, nationalisation of the commanding heights of the economy. All the great steel, coal, iron companies of Britain's provinces nationalised. Power, provinces to London. Taxation, 1950s, taxation at 98p in the pound. Any capitalist making money, the whole lot went to London, to the Chancellor. How much is left to regenerate the capitalist system? Nothing. Success of Liverpudlian industry in 1950, 60, they decide they want to cash their chips. If they sold to the City of London quoted companies, they paid no tax, they got shares in exchange. If they sold to their mates in Liverpool, they paid capital gains tax. What the hell were they supposed to do? Sell to London. Power from Liverpool to London. Local government was treated with contempt by central government. They never believed they were any good. And so what do? They took more and more power away from them and they introduced more and more central controls. Tories, housing corporation, took local authority housing out of the hands of local government in many ways because it was no good. And it wasn't any good. So to that extent, when Keith Joseph did it, it was a legitimate choice, but it was the wrong choice. What he should have done is to concentrate on how to make local government better so that it was doing the job properly. And so you go on. And then, of course, the power in the hands of the central government departments, all the bureaucrats in Liverpool Town Hall and Manchester Town Hall, housing people looked up to London Ministry of Housing, transport to the Ministry of Transport, Environment to the Department of Environment, Home Office to the Home Office, you know. So that completely compartmentalised local government and made it answerable to central government. Central government imposed more standards, more ring-fenced grants, took more power away, and hollowed out a great deal of the discretion of local government. So that's 50 years of accumulated transfer of power from the provinces to London. And, of course, the takeover processes created the branch office phenomenon. I mean, the people who built this city 100 and X years ago were big, independent, rough guys who were proud of what they'd done. They'd made their brass and they were going to spend it here. Today, in a large number of cases, although this is changing, it's a very important change, it is now, it had become it by the 1980s, branch offices. And branch managers do not put their heads above the parapet. Their job is to be nice to the bosses, wherever the bosses, in London, and don't cause any trouble, don't say anything that might upset anybody, and just go along the best you can and keep going. That's what branch managers do. No complaint, that's what a branch manager would do. But that isn't how you make great cities. So, that was 50 years. And so you ask me what the situation was like in Liverpool in 1981. The consequence of all that, no one could take decisions.
But when you talk about the renewal of local government, I know that you've been a big advocate of elected mayors, directly elected mayors. Why do you think that sort of position would help a city like Liverpool?
Well, just let's assume that today something happens that the Scots don't like the look of. What will be on tonight's television? Alex Salmond.
Who we don't like the look of.
I'm not going to express a personal view one way or the other, but what I would say is that the Scottish interest is articulated night after night after night by Alex Salmond, always arguing their case, whether it's right or wrong, is neither here nor there, but no one can fault the fact, A, that I know who it is, and B, that he will always do it, and C, that he will always say something that helps Scotland. Now, what happens in Liverpool? Whoever hears from the present leaders of Britain's England cities? They do in London. Give me one good reason why London should have Boris Johnson and Birmingham, Manchester, Newcastle, Liverpool shouldn't have the equivalent. One good reason. Well, you can't. There isn't one. And so someone who's in charge and someone who is elected by the whole community and therefore not answerable to the much narrower requirements of a party. This might sound as though I'm arguing against party politics, and in part I am. The fact of the matter is that if you have someone who has to say, I speak for Liverpool, they've got to see the balance of Liverpool, the whole of it, not just the party interests of where they happen to have their safe seats or whatever it may be. So, look around you. Tell me another economy such as ours, which haven't got mayors. They've all got mayors, and they're all big local people who matter and who say things and do things and can take a lead. And in their hands, the power of all those committees and all those warring factions in local government, they're all in one person's hands. That is a dynamic potential.
And clearly there is an imbalance between the southeast or London in terms of where power is concentrated and the provinces. Do you think the establishment of local enterprise partnerships, which the coalition governments are going to introduce over the next few months, will help in that regard?
Well, we will see. They are the successor of the regional development agencies or authorities. And so that is... that's what they're meant to do, and it is a shift of concept from what is essentially more central government, the regional development authorities, to a local authority, local industry, local commerce type partnership. well, that's the present government's intention, and we will see how it works.
Okay. I know you're here to launch a very important fund tomorrow, the Regional Growth Fund. I think there's perhaps a little bit confusion within the business community that actually that fund can only be accessed through things like LEPs, but I think it's more flexible than that, isn't it? If you could just sort of describe what the intention of that fund is, who it's available to.
Yes, those are important questions, and I'm going to speak about that in Liverpool. The fund is a challenge fund. Anyone can bid for support from the Regional Development Fund. There are conditions. The purpose of the fund is to recognise that there are certain parts of the English economy which are more dependent on public expenditure than others. And the object of the fund is to try and compensate by creating private sector jobs in areas adversely affected by the cuts. Who can apply? Anyone can apply. There is a ceiling of £1 million below which bids won't be entertained. I mean, we can't deal with £10,000 applications all over the country. And but above that, a private company can apply, a local authority, private sector partnership can apply, a funding unit of, say, venture capitalists could apply, partnerships of all the mix can apply. The one lot that would not have a chance would be a totally public sector bid. The object is to create jobs. There is no prescription about what sort of jobs we create. We're not trying to say it's high tech or low tech or anything like that. If someone can create jobs in these relatively underprivileged areas, that's the condition that we are interested in seeing fulfilled in the private sector. And then there's one absolutely vital point that I want to explain, because I know from my own experience, and you will all know, that in the less privileged areas, the most likely dynamic will come from small and medium-sized companies. If you have a ceiling of £1 million, frankly, you're talking about a handful of companies that even think in terms of investment scale of that sort. So I have had conversations with the four major clearing banks, and in principle we have agreed that they will seek to make bids to my fund for £1 million, which will be an aggregation of small bids, and they can package together. Now, there are two virtues in this. One, it gets to the small and medium-sized enterprise, but the second one is that the clearing banks have got branch managers. Now, how are you faced with the problem I've got? I mean, how do I replicate anything like that? Well, you couldn't. So going to the clearers was an obvious step, and in principle, we've agreed that we'll try and work together. So that's really where we are. But perhaps I should say one other thing. I do get asked, what sort of bids do you want? That's to miss the whole point. It's up to you to decide what sort of bids I want. And it's a competitive process. So be ingenious, think about it, work it out, get into partnerships, make arrangements, do whatever it likes. Come and tell me what you'll do if my fund contributes some money to help you. Of course, I will perhaps look to see how much you're going to help yourselves on the way. And not that I don't want you to make profit or anything like that, but if you think the fund, your ideas are so good, I might be reasonably expected to ask you to put a bit of money in. And so we look to see what you're prepared to put in the context of where you ask my fund to put something in.
I know we're running short of time, so just one final question, if I may. 30 years ago was when you first sort of came to Liverpool, had a look at the place. What do you think of Liverpool today, having spent the morning here, having a look around the new developments and so on?
Well, I came to Liverpool, to the northwest, long, long before that. My father commanded a training battalion of Royal Engineers in 1941 in Clitheroe. Well, it's not Liverpool, but it is sort of, you know, regional anyway. I came up here to take part in party political activities. But let's get back to the substance of your your question, what do I think today? Well, there's a bit of me that will always be Liverpool. You couldn't have given as much time and effort and commitment as I gave without it rubbing off and getting under the skin. So I've kept coming back, to be frank. I mean, I don't make a thing of it, but I do occasionally sort of have a look round and remember those extraordinary days. It's vastly exciting. I mean, what's happened, it has no parallel since the Victorians built the city. I mean, there's not been anything like this in 100 years, and that's absolutely extraordinary. Now, what does that mean? It means that things are happening, that there's a dynamic, it's on the way up, you've only got to look, you can see it, so why shouldn't it go on? We're going this way, not that way. And it's, I mean, I'm not trying to flatter anyone, but you're only going to look at a room like this. It wouldn't have looked like this 30 years ago. You know, there are now players. And I mean, one of my things in life is to be able to spot players. I mean, I can tell when I've got an audience which is dead on its feet, and I can tell when I've got an audience which has got a gleam in the eye.
I do apologise. We did our best.
A gleam in the eye, you know. I can see that the place is on the move. But if I have, can I have one more observation?
You certainly can.
If you'd ask me the question, what is the most emotional experience you have from your time here? It would have been in 1981 when, it was a very grueling experience doing those three weeks. There was no respite and the climate was very rough and you had all these pressures and time scale was enormous. And at the end of the evening, when everyone else had gone and I was on the top floor of the Atlantic Tower, I used to look out over the Mersey. And one night, I looked at the Mersey and I thought, it's criminal what we've done to you. You are the lifeblood of this city, and we've turned you into an open sewer. It is appalling. And I'm going to do something about it. And I think within hours almost, we announced the Clean the Mersey campaign. And the words I remember using were from the source to the sea. We will take the tiniest little streams and we will work the Mersey clean to the sea. And 25 years later, the birds were back, the seals were back, and all that sort of thing. But they stopped the campaign. The Mersey isn't clean. You know, it's cleaner. It's quite different than what it was, but why stop? It should be drinking water, you know? Just think of the tourists that would come, and all sorts of things that would happen. Of course, you know, I could get carried away. I would love to see the barrage built, to be frank. I mean, that great sea of water could be the playground of great swathes of England. But then I'm you can see why I'm regarded as highly irresponsible and unreliable.
Lord Heseltine, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you with us this afternoon. On behalf of Liverpool as a city, thank you for your contribution over many, many years. We hope you keep coming back and we hope you will continue to see the progress that the city's made. Can I ask you to show your appreciation for Lord Michael Heseltine?
This is Downtown Liverpool in Business on City Talk 105.9.
Right, I've never done a radio programme like this before where we've actually done something live like this and we've had audience participation. But I'm sure, first of all, that you'll agree how interesting and engaging Lord Heseltine is and some of the stories that he's actually able to tell. And when you think back to the time that he arrived. We were actually talking on one of the programmes recently. The Boys from the Black Stuff is being repeated or has been repeated fairly recently on BBC4. And it showed the Albert Dock in its opening sequence. And the place was an absolute disgrace at that time. And, you know, without question, the work that the Heseltine and his team, who included Max Steinberg at that time, did begin the transformation that we see today. Anybody who wants to comment on what Lord Heseltine had to say, John Haynes from the International Coaching Academy.
First of all, I'd like to thank Lord Heseltine in his absence for absolutely incredible feedback on his period from the 1980s for many years, how the toxic riots, etc. I was around at the time, and I assure you it wasn't an easy time for Liverpool. It was just a situation what Lord Heseltine said, as he's left a legacy for this city, possibly nobody else has ever left before, with what he said about the Mersey, the Albert Dock and the 30 projects. But one thing that has stung me loud and clear, he was talking about the Scottish gentleman on the television every night, really talking about Scotland get every opportunity. And he said, where are the people who are promoting Liverpool, speaking on behalf of Liverpool? There is none. Now, that's really got me thinking, what the heck is going on? I believe in every great city, every great business, you've got to have a leadership with a vision and have the courage. So I totally believe in Joe Anderson and his team, but I would really want to know now, are we getting represented strongly enough in the powers to be so we can also help leave a legacy? Lord Heseltine has left the legacy. Will all leadership team from the City Council leave their legacy?
Okay, thanks, John. I think by all accounts, the government are going to give all the major cities in England the opportunity of having elected mayors. I think there's likely to be a referendum on the subject in May. And, you know, it will basically be up to people to decide whether or not that's the route they want to take. And I think there's two issues there, really. I think the first thing is whether or not if each of the 11 cities decided they wanted a mayor, you would ever get the sort of profile and publicity that, you know, the First Minister of Scotland gets and indeed the Mayor of London gets, because we are obsessed with London, in my opinion, in this country. I think it is a problem that we're unfortunately having to live with. But secondly, you don't necessarily need to have leaders on the television and in the newspapers every day to actually develop a vibrant, dynamic economy. And we only have to look to Manchester to see that that's not the case. What you do need, I think, is full-time, dynamic political leadership. And that's what they've enjoyed in Manchester for probably over 20 years now, and what we've not really seen develop in Liverpool. Now, personally, I think up until very, very recently, we could have argued fairly strongly for the fact that that would never happen without the introduction of something like an elected mayor. But of course, we've now had a new administration elected in May. We have got a full-time political leader, and who knows what that's going to actually result in. But again, if the polls are to be believed, and there's been an awful lot of poll and evidence that suggests the people in Liverpool and other cities, but Liverpool particularly, are actually in favour of an elected mayoral system. And if that happened, then I think at least we've got a political leader now probably will put himself forward for that job, and at least will be able to say he's got a track record of doing the job full time, which I think has been a real bonus to the city. What we've seen so far is much more engagement with the city's leadership and the business community than perhaps has been the case in the past. Right, any other questions or comments? John.
In the context of elected mayors, I'm a little concerned that if we have an elected mayor, we should have an elected mayor for the Liverpool City region rather than for Liverpool itself. We're all very well connected together, and would that work with the existing local government setup we've got? I just feel that that would be a much more effective way forward and represent the city region.
I think it's a very good point, John. And again, when I've discussed this with both ministers and shadow ministers, the idea of metropolitan mayors, which cover the whole of the city region, is something that's been discussed. And if you look at London, for example, and the size of the geographical area that Boris Johnson actually covers, and that particular post covers, it's huge in comparison to other English cities. I think, though, inevitably, if you had an elected mayor for Liverpool, they would be seen as the leader for the city region. And I think it'd probably be easier for a person with that sort of elected authority to lead other authorities in the city region to a strategy that could be agreed. But I take your point, and I think, you know, a city region model perhaps is something that could be explored in the future. The other thing I'd say to you, John, is that, You know, if you look over to local government reorganisation in Cheshire, where I think they had six or seven local authorities and it was a two-tier local government situation with a county council and then a series of district councils, they abolished that, I think, 3 years ago now, and you've got two unitary authorities. And when you talk to people in Cheshire, two things have happened. Firstly, it's far easier to deal with local government because there's less of it. And secondly, they've saved literally hundreds of millions of pounds through the process. And I, for the life of me, can't understand why Merseyside's got, I think it's six local councils or seven, covering an area that's minute, really. You know, if you went to the States and said, this area, we've got seven different local authorities, near enough 600 councillors, seven chief executives all on over £100,000 apiece, and executive teams alongside them on similar salaries. How can that make any sense when we're supposedly looking at a public expenditure cut of quite literally millions of pounds over the next few years? So I think it's a debate that's going to happen, but I think the elected mayor for the cities is certainly the referendum that will happen if that does kick in May. Hi, Tony. Frank.
My name's Tony Middleton from Sofrito Restaurant in Whitechapel. Just an observation, really. I was at the lunch 30 years ago when Heseltine announced the regeneration ideas that he had for the city. And I remember Liverpool then, and I worked here every day, and it was desperate. And there was no activity in the city at all in the evenings. Everybody went home. There was no sense of community in the business sense. And then I left. And only recently have I come back to help open this restaurant. And I've come back and I've seen such a fantastic change. I don't think I've ever seen a city change as much in a relatively short period of time. And I walk around this city now, and the enthusiasm and the excitement that you get when you're talking to people is absolutely amazing. And as Heseltine said before, you know, with what we've got going now and with the investment that's coming in the future, we can only see one way for this city, and it's going to keep going up. And I think it's absolutely great, and I'm delighted to be a part of it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, Brian. Brian Furlong from Horizon. Basically, we're a new company that's come into Liverpool, and obviously I'm on the other side of the border, one of Mr. Salmon's population. But firstly, Mr. Heseltine's speech, I was actually enthralled by it, you know, the passion he's got for this city. And, you know, the guys just went so high in my estimation at the moment. But coming to your city and seeing the passion for it, the drive of the local communities, is like nothing I've ever seen in any other city before. And I'd just like to say, I think it's incredible. Just keep going the way you're going. I mean, success will come to this city, and if we can help it come here, we will make it come here. You know, the passion here is phenomenal. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Roy, he's never short of a word or two. I don't think Roy ran out from Entwistle. Don't think you even indicated there, Roy. We just knew you'd want to say something.
No, I didn't indicate, Frank. Thanks a lot. Well, in my eyes, Michael Heseltine is a god. What he did for this city was just incredible. And I do remember the derelict land that was the Albert Dock. One thing that always sticks in my mind is the Garden Festival. It wasn't a place I actually wanted to visit because I really wasn't into flowers at that time, but my girlfriend was. She dragged me along to the Garden Festival site. It was absolutely amazing, and I went 6 days on the run. So,
don't tell us what you were doing. Did you take the same girl back six times?
Of course not.
Here's the tip, Roy. That's why you got dumped. All right. Mr. Carr, would you like to say a few words? Mike Carr from NSG UK.
Well, what an incredible speech. A fantastic ambassador for this particular city. An awful lot of work that was done at grassroots level. There has been a lasting legacy for Michael Heseltine's work. Everybody has to admit that. I think it's incredible, the amount of work and passion that Michael's got for this city. We should be very, very grateful for that.
We're also joined today by Esther McVeigh, who's the MP for Wirral West. A beacon on your own as a Conservative in this part of the world. But you must be delighted, first of all, to see Lord Heseltine in the city again. And also, you know, you and I have been having a number of conversations over the last few months since you were elected about how we can get Liverpool and the Wirral working more closely together. And something that John Sutcliffe referred to earlier, the city region actually operating a bit more strategically and effectively than it has in the past. First of all, what did you make of Lord Heseltine's contribution today? And secondly, where do you think that city region agenda is at the moment?
Well, it's not just what his contribution was today. It's what it's been for years and years and years. And I think he's been a man of his word. He came here, as he said, in 79. Regeneration of a city doesn't take 1 year, 2 year, three or five. It takes 20. And really, you're only reaping the benefit of some of the things he did 30 odd years ago. And I just think it's absolutely spectacular that a man who could be doing other things, a man who's got an international company, still comes back here, wants to see what's happened, and he's seen everything through. So I think that dedication is completely to be admired, and he again is stepping up to the starting line. He said, let's look at the Regional Growth Fund, if there was ever a man who would look at the bids coming forward. And he said, I'm not prescriptive, it's a blank sheet of paper, a job is a job is a job. I'm not going to say what an area is going to be, but just let's help it develop, let's help it expand. And I know he's on a phenomenal tour of the area, and like he said, he does frequently come back, so all credit. And he is a visionary, and something else, he has a specific interest in ports. So when London took off, London Dockland, he was the visionary behind it, saying, look at that, that's an incredible piece of land. People would want to be there, and we now have to capitalise on that. It is vital, and I work with the Department of Transport, with Phil Hammond, with Mike Penning, and we've got to say, what are we doing here at Liverpool? Let's get that terminal sorted. Let's get it right, whatever it takes. Liverpool has to expand. I believe it's only half of a city, actually, without its port. We need to do that. And again, Waters, phenomenal piece of land there. It is open. We are open for business. We have got very dynamic, bright people from this area. So let's take it forward. I'm really proud to come from this area. I'm delighted to represent it. And trust me, I am lobbying on behalf of this area all the time. And from my own point of view, I think Liverpool's done well at the moment. We've got the Royal Liverpool Hospital. Let's get that started. That's £451 million. That's going to go construction. That's going to go to development. That's going to go to a hospital. That's going to go for a centre of excellence in biochemical and move forward. Okay, we've got the Mersey Gateway. That's another pledge we've had come forward. We've got the Liverpool to Manchester electrification. We've got the tourism here. There is so much. So let's grasp it. Let's grab it. And I will be lobbying as well.
When you've been lobbied by Esther McFay, you know you've been lobbied. Right, thanks to Lord Michael Heseltine. Thanks to the event sponsor, Liverpool Vision. Thanks to our host, the Crown Plaza Hotel. And most of all, thank you for being with us today. And thanks to the listeners. Have a great week and don't do anything I wouldn't do. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
105.9
So it's City Talks Business. Mick Coyle here from City Talk Breakfast with Frank McKenna. Frank, we speak on a weekly basis, quarter to eight on a Friday morning. Often we talk about a number of the issues which were discussed today. First and foremost, I think a lot of people, as we heard in the questions there, took away the idea of the elected mayor. When you hear somebody like Michael Heseltine putting that idea across, it sounds like a great idea, but then when it comes down to the reality of it, people start talking about names, party politics get involved as well. It's a popularity contest at the end of the day. How do you go from the idea to the reality?
Well, I think those points that you raised there, Mick, are all good ones and would be a legitimate point of debate in terms of having a referendum as to whether the City of Liverpool do feel that an elected mayor is the way to go. But I think the offer ought to be made and the opportunity ought to be given to people to say, is this a better way of being governed than the system that we have at the moment? As you've heard me say in the session there, I think that we're in a very new time politically in Liverpool because we do have a full-time political leader, something that Manchester's enjoyed for over 20 years, something that's fairly new to this city. So
people may take the view, let's see if this works, you know, full-time political leader without necessarily the title of elected mayor. But as you say, when you hear Heseltine talking about other cities, not just London, but cities around Europe, cities around the world, who have that elected leadership, and that elected leadership does give you a legitimacy that perhaps existing council leaders don't have. So it's certainly a debate worth having. And for me, I think you have to take away the issue and the roles and responsibilities a mayor might have, rather than saying, well, you know, would it be Joe Anderson, would it be Warren Bradley, would it be Phil Redmond, would it be Frank McKenna? You know, it's not about the personality, it's about what role responsibility those people would have, and also whether or not the powers that those people would have would be greater than existing council leaders have, and would they be able to get the sort of financial backing that perhaps existing council leaders and structures don't allow?
We've seen in London Boris Johnson, Ken Livingstone before him, that mayoral role is very much a political role. You get the sense today that maybe actually a future role in Liverpool will be more about business.
Well, I think whoever took that position would need to have certainly the support of the business community, but also an understanding and the ability to engage with the private sector. And again, I think that you've seen from the current administration, and you could argue as well from people like Mike Storey, and to an extent Warren Bradley as well, they worked hard to make sure that the private sector, the business community, was consulted with. But I think more importantly than that, what Lord Heseltine was talking about today were individuals who've actually not just got an understanding of the business community, but actually a background in business. So I think Giuliani in New York was perhaps business involved before he took that particular job. And then subsequently they've elected private sector leaders to what are considered at the moment in this country as political roles. I think in the northeast, in Middlesbrough, the guy who was known as Robocop was elected as mayor there. So it does open the door, perhaps, to people outside of the party political system. But my guess is, my gut instinct, is if we had a elected mayor in Liverpool, it would be somebody who was backed by a political party. I don't think that this city is ready to be as radical as, yet we'll have an elected mayor and we'll elect somebody who is not from the mainstream political system.
And finally, just on the point about the LEPs, these £1 million pots which are there for the taking, you know, we had many delegates from many different businesses here in the room. It's going to be a bit of a scrap, isn't it, just for people to get hold of that money. You know, is that something which is actually beneficial, or can things turn a little bit ugly?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the only question that was put to him that he was a little bit vague on, in my opinion, was LEPs. And I think that's because they're not quite sure what they want yet. And I think they are waiting for people to come forward with ideas where they can say that would be something that we could back, and we could say we're backing a winner. So I think it's a great opportunity. I think there's a blank sheet of paper almost for private sector companies with good ideas to go forward and independently of the public sector actually say, we think this will work and we're prepared to throw in some of our cash, but can you assist us so that that idea, that initiative can grow more effectively and more quickly than would otherwise be the case? So I think they're finding the feet with it. And I think what he was basically saying today was, you know, we're not quite sure what we're going to do with this. Let us have your ideas and we'll get back to you. I don't think it'll turn into a free-for-all, because these things very seldom do. And often, you know, the small and medium enterprises that clearly they're looking to get involved in these things haven't got the time or the inclination to engage with the process. So I'm not quite sure, I'm not convinced yet, that we won't actually see going forward local authorities working in partnership with the private sector, and the bulk of the bids that are successful being that route, rather than independent companies going on their own and trying to get through what will be a hell of a bureaucracy by the sounds of things.
Next week's show, Lady Thatcher and Neil Kinnock.
Well, why not? That'd be nice, wouldn't it? And we'll throw Derek Hatton in for good measure.
This is Downtown Liverpool in Business on City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9, official podcasts, online at citytalk.fm.